it's time to start. Other people will be coming in, that's fine, but I want to get started. The reason I have this picture of the book here, which actually hasn't appeared yet, I just got the, this week, just a few days ago, I got the cover, which I think is beautiful. I thought I'd show it to you simply because, well, first of all, as I said, it is beautiful, but the book has about 70 or so pages of before and after of censorship, and lo and behold, the publisher, the people who designed this, the cover, they don't read Hebrew, but they took a page, and they, as you see, they made it very interesting, you know, blocking out, you know, that's number 8, responsum number 8. Lo and behold, if we enlarge it, what do we see? We see it's the Rav Pealim, the responsa of Rav Yosef Chaim, of the Ben Ish Chai. So this is just coincidence or Ashkacha Pratis, whatever you say, that lo and behold, we're doing a class on him. And this is what the title of the book the cover page of the book is going to look like. And I will discuss this responsum, not this class, probably next class, what made it so controversial that it had to be literally whited out as we see. But the book will not be out by Hanukkah. That's what you're referring to. Maybe you're referring to the little light there, but it definitely will not be out because I'm reading the proofs now. And as I said, it's very complicated. There's about 1,300 different sources being cited, and I need to make sure everything is lined up with each other. But almost there. Remember, it doesn't pay to get a book out a month or two earlier, since it's going to last to the end of time. You might as well do it right. Let me tell you right now that I'm going to go until 10 to 10, and then for the last 10 minutes, I'm going to give you something special. The book is not censored, not to fear. I'm going to give you something that's never before appeared in print. I'm not going to do it now, because if I did it now, I think we might get involved in a discussion of 20, 30 minutes, and I don't want to get off sidetrack now, but at the end I could. It's regarding a matter that a number of you asked me about, Rav Huttner and the hijacking. I have information that I will tell you that, like I said, has never appeared in print. The whole story has never appeared, and I will give it to you at the end. Before we start, just a couple things. First of all, I misspoke a little bit when I was talking last class about, I said the Mashkichim, the Eidah Haredi Mashkichim in Jordan. It turns out I misremembered. They were not Eidah Haredi. Here they are. They're actually what they call Sheris Yisrael. That's the Litvish. It comes out of the Rav Shach circles, their Hashkacha. And they battle with the Eidah Haredis over getting the new contracts. So it isn't exactly Eidah Haredis, but it's pretty much the same thing. Look how they dressed when they went to Jordan, because they don't want to use Israeli produce because of the Heter Mechira. So they go to Jordan, and this is the picture of what they looked like. Number one. Number two. I want to tell you something that Mel, who's with us, pointed out to me, and he's correct. I was using my yeshivish pronunciation. I kept saying schar, and actually that's what we call a construct. Like you would say schar pesios, schar pesiot, or something like that. But used on its own, the correct pronunciation is not schar, it's sachar, kamatz kamatz. Unlike the word paras, by the way, pay reward, in which it's always paras, it's not paras. So thank you, Mel, for pointing it out to me. I did also mention to Mel, although he's not as confident, that I said that now with Arts Scroll being so popular, and everyone using it, including yeshivish people, I think we might see the ends, if not soon, eventually, of some yeshivish pronunciations. For example, Masechta's like Horios, which is really Horios, Horayot, or Arachin, which is Eruchin. The Art Scroll gives the correct pronunciation. So since everyone uses it, I would think that would soon go by the wayside. Mel doesn't think so. Also, Art Scroll is now publishing another monumental series, and that's the Midrash Rabbah. Since everyone who buys it sees on the front page and on the side where it says Midrash, how long can people go on calling it Medrash? I don't know. I'm hopeful. And finally, just a correction to something I said. I referred to the Riaz, and I said that's of Trani. I said Isaiah of Trani, the elder. It's actually the younger, the Riaz. The Rid is the elder. As soon as I said it, I realized that the Rid is the elder. Riaz stands for Rabbi Yeshaya Acharon Zal. So correct that. Okay, and as I said, we'll get... Oh, one more thing. And this is pointed out to me by someone from Israel, Dov, who doesn't listen live, but listens to the tape. I was talking about wearing the tefillin, the double tefillin, and I said, at least this was my recollection, I think I'm wrong now, that they wear it one next to each other. If someone has ever seen them do it like that, tell me. But he says that he's seen it, and they wear one tefillin here and one tefillin on top, and on the arm, they do the exact same thing with Rabbeinu Tam on top. And he sent me where this appears in the Ben Ish Chai, where the Ben Ish Chai actually rejects the idea that you put on like Chabad does. First put on Rashi and then put on Rabbeinu Tam. And he says you have to put it on together at the same time, and both the arm and the head. So like I said, I could be misremembering unless someone can testify that there are people who actually wear the small tefillin one next to each another, but of course they have to be very small to put them behind as well. And the last point I want to mention before we begin, that is today is the Yortzeit 20 years of Rav Shlomo Goren. Actually now it's not because it's dark where I am. Those in California, it still is. You can go on YouTube and see all sorts of very interesting videos about him, interviews with him, etc., the liberation of the Kotel. And if you haven't heard our classes on Rav Shlomo Goren, I recommend that for those who are interested. It's actually one of the most popular lectures I give now, scholars in residence. A lot of people want to hear about him. So without any further ado, let us pick up right now where we left off. I want to pick up with a question that Yisrael asked me about the population figures, which I unfortunately neglected to mention, but I have them here now. For 1884, that's right during the Ben Ish Chai's lifetime, we have 30,000 Jews. In 1907, there are 50,000 Jews in Baghdad with a population, a general population, of 185,000. So you're talking more than a quarter of the population was Jewish in a big city like Baghdad. Let me close this out. For those who are just coming on, I can't resist. Let me just show you this. And then we are on. It's not available yet, but I'm getting excited, so I just want to show you. There it is. Let's pull up the Ben Ish Chai here so we can look at his face. The last thing we did last class was dealing with the Ben Ish Chai going to Hebron and purchasing and suggesting on his way back to Baghdad, stopping in Damascus, that the Jews purchase Maaret HaMachpelah. The Ottoman government was willing, apparently, but the Muslims made a big stink, and nothing came of it. During this visit to Eretz Yisrael, he developed a relationship with the Mekubalim, the Kabbalists of Jerusalem. And we also know, or we're told, that he had mystical revelations of Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, during this trip, and he also had a mystical experience at the grave of Benayahu ben Yehoyada. He's described in the book of Samuel as being a great warrior, and the Talmud, if you look in Gittin, says all sorts of things about him, including that he was the one that Shlomo sent to capture who? Ashmedai, the king of the demons. How could he do that? By using the Shema Mephoresh, God's holy name. Now, this grave is found near Tzfat. Maybe one of you have seen it. I've never been to this grave. It was not known, though. There's no history, Benayahu. I mean, this is going back thousands of years. It was not known until the Ari, Rav Yitzhak Luria, identified it because of his Ruach HaKodesh. So if you're of the rationalist type, you're going to be skeptical of this identification, but the Ben Ish Chai accepted it, and he developed a great spiritual connection with Benayahu. In fact, he thought that his soul came from the same spiritual source as Benayahu. That doesn't mean, some people write that according to the Ben Ish Chai, he was the reincarnation, the Gilgul, of Benayahu? I don't think so. I've looked very carefully at how he describes it. He says that his soul originates. He could have very easily said that he was the reincarnation of Benayahu. People said things like that all the time. What he said was that his soul originated from the same spiritual sources as the soul of Benayahu, which it is not the same thing as Gilgul. It's not just this name Benayahu is significant for other reasons. The names of his books, listen to the names of some of the most famous books: Ben Ishchai, Benayahu, Ben Yehoyada, Rav Pe'alim, Mikabtzael, they all come from the same biblical story about this individual. By the way, Ben Ishchai is the Ketiv. But I was about to say the Kri, but since we're now being, we want to be very grammatical here, I will say not the Kri, but the Kere is with a Tzere under the Reish. The Kere is Ben Ishchayil, and he has another work. Ben Ishchai is the famous one, but he has another work as well called Ben Ishchayil. Now, this book, Mikab Tzael, was long thought to be lost. He refers to it numerous times, but it was thought to be lost. About 9 or 10 months ago, we learned that a section of the book survived and was in the hands of a year and a half ago, I think it was, we learned that the book survived and was in the possession of a London antiquities dealer. And it was about 6 months ago that it finally appeared in print for the very first time, the Mikab Tzael, or at least so everyone thought. And they put it out with all sorts of great fanfare and sold many copies. However, when people started examining the work, there was some skepticism. An article came out a few months ago by a rabbi in Israel who denies that this is Mikab Tzael. Instead, because, first of all, it doesn't have the characteristics of the book, which Rav Yosef Chaim describes. He claims that the new book is just halachot that were not included in the Ben Ishchai and were to be included in another version, edition of the Ben Ishchai. Remember, there were two years of the Ben Ishchai. And from what I can see, I think he is correct. His name is Rabbi Debda, and he has an article in Or Torah from Sivan of last year. So I don't think although there's a lot of propaganda announcing that this is the long lost Mikab Tzael, after all, if you want to sell lots of copies of a book, if you say it's a new thing from the Ben Ishchai, fine, you'll sell. But if you say it's the long lost Mikab Tzael, that for over 120 years, people have been wondering what happened to this book, you're going to sell a lot more. But if you look at the evidence, it appears to me that this is not the Mikab Tzael. Yechezkel tells us that he has been to the grave of Benayahu. It's near Amukah. Amukah is another kever, I believe, famous one where they go there. Is that the one they go there if you want to get a shidduch or you want to get pregnant or something like that? Kabbalah is central to the Ben Ishchai. And last year, the first academic article appeared by Yonatan Meir, who's really an excellent young scholar in Israel, on the Ben Ishchai and Kabbalah. I will be honest, I've been honest before, I'll be honest now and be honest in the future, I don't really understand all this Kabbalistic stuff. I have a basic general knowledge, but when it gets into detail, everything from Partsufim, Adam Kadmon, all this sort of thing, it's not something I've ever been really attracted to, and I don't understand it, so I'm not going to discuss it. We'll talk a little bit about Kabbalistic stuff later on, but be very surfacey. I guess I'm following in the Art Scroll tradition, because if any of you purchase the Art Scroll translation of Ramban, they tell you in the introduction that they are not going to be translating the sections of the Ramban on Chumash that deal with Kabbalah. So if you want to learn all about the Tikkunim and the Kavanot that the Ben Ishchai published and other Kabbalistic matters, I can send you Yonatan Meir's article. Let me return, though, to what I want to talk about, and that is other aspects, not so much Kabbalah, but in its essence, but quasi-Kabbalah or para-Kabbalah. One of the important aspects of that would be visiting graves. Mekubalim always thought that there was great significance of that. Today, it's not just Mekubalim. Rav Shach's yahrzeit site was it last week? I think it was last week. And everyone's going to his grave. They're making a big deal. That was never done in Lithuania. Do you know that Reichman asked Rav Shach, this is going back already into the 80s, when Reichman was the big financier and the philanthropist for all yeshivas in Israel, Ponevezh and the rest, he said that he would provide his private jet to Rav Shach so Rav Shach could go visit the Vilna Gaon's grave in Vilna. He'd go there and come back in one day. And at least this is what was, Rav Shach said no. And what was reported in the newspapers was he told Reichman as follows. I can't say if this is true, but it does reflect, I find it hard to believe it's true, but it does reflect a certain sentiment. Supposedly he said to Reichman that when I was in Vilna all those times, I never went to the Gruz Kever. So why should I go now all the way from Eretz Yisrael? And it's true that the Rambam says that we don't go visit Kvarim, and the Briskers never went. I do find it hard to believe that Rav Shach being in Vilna, just as a touristy thing, you know, who not to go see the Gruz, the famous Gruz grave. But that's the story, at least, and it was told to show that this is not what we do. And yet, as we know, the Lithuanian world has become Hasidic in many variations. I've already, in the past, I've shown you pictures of Rav Chaim Kanievsky giving out shiraim. So going to the grave on the Yort site becomes a very important thing as well. But from a Kubalim, this has always been important. There are a number of graves in Iraq, or maybe I should say supposed graves. Shlomo says that the Gaon was against going also. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that he talks, for example, halachic man, they don't go and all that, but when his wife passed away, he couldn't, the emotion was too much. And Rav Kafach has a nice article on this, stating that, you know, when you go to a kever, you can't read Tehillim, you can't do any of this stuff, because the Rambam says you're not allowed to learn, and a cemetery is not a holy place, it's a makom of tuma. But that's not, I guess, how the Jewish people as a whole have, you know, seen this. But it's true, they did not do, in Lithuania, they related very differently. There are many graves, or supposed graves, in Iraq. Let me just give you some names. Yecheskel, Hanavi, Ezra HaSofer, Daniel, Hanania, Mishael, Azariah, Yonah, Eov. I mean, the grave is only the real grave of Eov if you hold that Eov existed. If you hold that Eov never existed, it's a parable. By the way, yeah, you know, they have this view that Eov never existed. All that means is that Eov, the person we're talking about, who's described in these stories, never existed. That there was an Eov, there's no question, because he's mentioned elsewhere in Tanakh, the figure of Eov. When they say Eov never existed, though, they mean the Eov that we read about, that all these things happened to him. Rav Yossi HaGlili, and finally, Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. These are just some of the most famous graves that are traditionally found in Iraq. Now, some of these attributions are quite old. For example, Rav Sharira Gaon, I found, refers to the graves of Yecheskel, Daniel, and Ezra. When I say quite old, what's Rav Sharira? 9th century? So you're still talking well more than 1,000 years after the events. So there's no historical legitimacy to any of these identifications. I don't even think any of them are Jewish identifications. At least some of them certainly are not Jewish identifications, but they're very old as opposed to all these new identifications that recently popped up. Rav Sharira refers to another one, Baruch ben Neria, assistant, I guess you could say, to Yirmiyah, who until recent discoveries was the only biblical figure of whom we had extra biblical evidence of. We have an inscription that refers to Baruch ben Neria. Now, these were Jewish sites, the ones I mentioned, not simply Muslim sites, all of these. That is, the Muslims also identified with them, but they were also Jewish sites. And there was actually yeshivot. You know, these were Yecheskel and Ezra and Yehoshua, Kohen Gadol, specifically Jewish sites. And there were yeshivas in these places. You can go on Wikipedia. Wikipedia really has become incredible. If not often you find the articles have errors in it, but just the links or something else. There's a Wikipedia entry for Yechezkel's tomb. I have it here, complete with a picture. And it gets even better because there's a link here to a 3.5 minute video. I was going to show it to you because I can put my computer screen on the screen here, but I figure if you're interested, you can go on your own. I don't need to spend the 3 minutes doing that. And you can watch, just go to Ezekiel's tomb. A team of journalists from the New York Times visited in the fall of 2010, and they recorded. Now it's a completely Muslim site, because the Muslims, all the prophets in the Old Testament, the Muslims accept them as well. But they show you picture video around the tomb, and you see Hebrew writing. So it doesn't look like any time in the near future we'll be able to go visit there. But that is a Jewish site. Yes, Mel tells us that ISIS is continuing his rampage. They destroyed the tomb of Jonah. Exactly. I don't know if the tomb of Jonah there is originally a Jewish identification, which the Muslims came onto, or originally a Muslim. See, some of these tombs are originally Jewish, and then the Muslims also went to it. Some of them are also originally Muslim, and the Jews jumped onto it. And some of them are only Muslim. For example, in Iran, there's you can find Kever. I think they have Esther's tomb and Mordechai. As far as I know, there's no Jewish connection whatsoever for that. This site, by the way, Yechezkel's tomb, is 150 kilometers from Baghdad. I also found that it was discussed in a very interesting book called 8 Years in Asia and Africa. From 1846 to 1855, this is written by a man named Israel Joseph Benjamin. He was a religious Jew. He came from a Chabad background. And he, for 8 years, he was a journeyman. Then he came to America, and he wrote another book about America. You can go on Google Books and see this, and you can order it. I have my university library. They bind it for you, and they send it. And he describes his visit to Iraq, his journey, the stuff he did. Wasn't exactly safe, but he talks about, on page 158, going to the tomb of the prophet Ezekiel. And he tells us how you get into the tomb, and then he says that according to the tradition of the Jews, there's two paintings on the side of it, that they are pictures of Yechezkel and King Jehoiachin. And he continues talking about this and other places. They have an old Torah, he said there, etc. Ezra's tomb is another important tomb, which the Muslims also accepted. There's a very nice Wikipedia page on this, which I encourage as well people to read. As for Daniel's grave, here you have a disagreement, because the Muslims assume that it's in Iran, but the Jews of Iraq said it was in Kirkuk, which... whether it's still in existence, I don't know, all the fighting, but because Kirkuk, you've heard it in the news. And then there's another tomb I saw from Wikipedia, which they attribute to Daniel, that's located in Mosul, Iraq, but that doesn't exist anymore because it was destroyed in July of 2014, just a few months ago. And then there's another place. Kirkuk, though, is the Jewish identification, and there was a synagogue, which was later turned into a church, and then into a mosque. Finally, there's the tomb of Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. And I have that as well here. This Yeshua Kohen Gadol is mentioned in the book of Zechariah. He was the first Kohen Gadol after the Jews returned to Eretz Yisrael. If you look on Wikipedia, they tell you that in 1825, the traditional tomb of Joshua was reported to have been found at 1 hour's distance from Baghdad. Actually, here's an example of a mistake in Wikipedia. If you go back to the source, this old source, what you find is that the source was written, it dates from 1825, but it was already a recognized site. A Jewish site in 1825, so of course it goes back much sooner. The bigger problem is, how does the Yehoshua Kohen Gadol from Eretz Yisrael end up being buried outside of Baghdad? As far as I know, no one's ever answered that question. Now, in Zechariah, he is referred to, this Kohen Gadol, is referred to as Yehoshua. But in the book of Ezra, he is referred to as Yeshua, without the hey. This shows us that Jesus' name, Yeshua, would have also been Yehoshua, Joshua. And Christians make a typological connection between Joshua in the book of Joshua and Jesus. But his name is not Yeshua, as many people think, although that's a nice name. What's wrong with the name Yeshua? Salvation or something like that. But Jesus' name would have been Yehoshua. The Ben Ishchai mentions these graves. He refers to the fact that Yechezkel and others are buried in Bavel rather than having been brought to Eretz Yisrael after death as proof that they held, that is, that Yechezkel and the people in his generation held, just like the more recent sages of the Ben Ishchai's day, that it was more appropriate to be buried in the diaspora if they lived there. This goes back to a Yerushalmi that states that, and I understand why it's a Yerushalmi, because in the people in Eretz Yisrael probably didn't like this, that the Yerushalmi says that all these people lived in their Chutz Aretz. They never made the difficult journey, to live in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, why do they think that they should have the right to be buried in Eretz Yisrael if they never lived in Eretz Yisrael? So the Yerushalmi has a negative perspective on people after death being buried there, and the Ben Ishchai held of this and said that same, and we see that that's why Yechezkel was buried and other greats, why their bones were not brought to Eretz Yisrael. As I mentioned last class, the Ben Ishchai never served as official rabbi in Baghdad or of Iraq or rabbi of anything, even of a local shtibel, not at all. Or of head of a yeshiva, he never served as Av Beis Din, yet his reputation spread, and he was asked questions from near and far because of his reputation for piety, for scholarship. He would occasionally be brought in to sit on the Beis Din, but he was never Av Beis Din. He would be consulted by them. He even answers questions from India, where there was a nice Iraqi community, and China, where there also was a nice community. A small community. There was a sefer, by the way, published by an Iraqi Jew in China, a little volume of Sheot and Tshuvot, but the Ben Ishchai asked questions from there. So how did the Ben Ishchai make his living? He's not being supported as a rabbi. He was the Baghdad representative of the well-known merchant family, the Sassoon family, David Sassoon, who were Iraqi business people living in India. And then later on, the family spreads and moves into England. We will later, in the past, we have dealt with, and we had the classes around Nissim, Flora Sassoon, that brilliant Jewish woman. Before there was any such thing as maharats and seminaries or anything like that, you had a real Talmidah Chacham named Flora Sassoon, but we'll get back to Flora Sassoon when we deal with her relationship with the Ben Ishchai, and we'll talk more about the Sassoon family. For now, let's just say that this was royalty in the Iraqi community. It still survives, the family. You have in New York, Chacham Yitzhak Sassoon, and the Ben Ishchai worked for them as he was their business representative in Baghdad. If you go, once again, to Wikipedia, you have a whole nice entry on the Sassoon family. We even have an English letter, by the way, from the Ben Ishchai discussing his business. Not that he wrote English, but for the English government, it had to be written. Yechezkel says, why Talmidah? I said Talmidah Chacham, he says Talmidah Chachamah. No, because it's a construct. I'm saying she's the Talmidah, she's the student Talmidah of a wise man. Talmid Chacham means student of a wise man. She is a student of a wise man, like the Ben Ishchai. A student of Flora Sassoon, a female student, would be the Talmidah Chachama. She would be the student of Flora Sassoon. But Flora Sassoon is really, in modern times, the first female scholar, we have to assume that all of our learning is from the men, which it is, as we spoke about. Incidentally, in terms of women titles, I basically believe that you should call people what they want to be called. So if I ever have the occasion, and we did, for those of you who were with me last summer in Central Europe, we were at the restaurant on Shabbos together with this whole traveling group of female rabbis. they were retracing the steps of Regina Jonas, who was the first female rabbi ever. She was ordained in Germany, and one of the signers of her smicha was an Orthodox man, Chanoch Albeck. He didn't want us. He didn't sign it. I'm sorry. Chanoch Albeck didn't sign it. You know, I can't remember now if Chanoch Albeck signed it. I know at first he didn't want to. I can't remember if he did. But she died in Theresienstadt, so they retraced her steps from where she was born, somewhere in Germany, to Theresienstadt. So lo and behold, Shabbos, we're in the restaurant. There's this whole group of women rabbis, including Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz, who's works at HAR. The other ones being ordained are not given the title Rabbah, they're given the title Maharat. The title Rabbah is the feminine of Rav. So I understand in the HIR synagogue, they call everyone Rav. So it's Rav Avi, it's Rav Steve, so she's Rabbah. But for the rest of us, we don't use titles like that. We refer to people as rabbis. So as far as I'm concerned, call her Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz, because that's what she is. A Rabbah is a rabbi. Truthfully, it's I'm not such a great fan of all this, but being that I have no problem calling conservative and reform rabbis rabbi, if that's what they want to be called, we don't consider them rabbis in the sense of how we regard rabbis, you know, poskim and authentic transmitters of the tradition, but we call them rabbis, and not only we do, Avi Shafran, I saw the other day, referred to a conservative rabbi as a rabbi. So if we can call conservative and reform rabbis the title rabbi, and if the Aguda representative can call it that, I don't see why they have such a problem referring to Sarah Hurwitz the same way. I mean, she definitely is at a much higher mila. She's a completely observant woman, and she's definitely on a higher level than the other rabbis. Getting back to the Ben Ish Chai, he was able to change, we spoke about his significance, and because of his importance, he was able to change many practices in Baghdad that he thought were mistaken. We discussed a few of them already in the first class. And we all know it's not an easy thing to change an entrenched minhag, even a minhag ta'ut, even a mistaken minhag. I want to change some minhagim in my shul. There's no way I'm going to be able to. Why the musaf? They don't daven in the middle of the shul. Somehow it started that they daven musaf right in the front. I don't know where that started. But you're never going to be able to change it. People get used to these things, and they regard it as standard. But the Ben Ish Chai, he had the authority to change. And many of the things he changed related to prayers. For instance, he instituted the recital of what we call Friday night Bracha Me'ein Sheva, the seven-faceted blessing. That's how I'm looking at my art scroll sitter here. Right after Shemona Esrei, when we say Magen Avos, the rule is that, if I look at my art scroll sitter here, it says that the following three paragraphs, that is, you say Vayechu, and then the following three paragraphs, Baruch, Magen Avos, and Malkeinu, are omitted by an individual praying alone or by an occasional minion, such as in the home of a mourner. That's our minhag, the Ben Ish Chai changed that practice. And says that even in an occasional minyan, that is a minyan at the house of a mourner, you do say the three paragraphs, because al pi ha-kabbalah, in accordance with Kabbalistic considerations, you should recite this even at an occasional minyan. Not by yourself, but at an occasional minyan. We had this situation. I have a minyan right by my house, which is occasional in the sense that the guy sends out an email Thursday, and since we're only about 13 men, if people are away and you don't have a minion, then there's no minion. But if we do have a minion, then there is a minion. So it seems like every other week we'll get a minion. And it's nice because it's much more convenient. It's right near where I live. He insisted all this time on not saying the three paragraphs because he says it's an occasional minion. We don't mean each week. His son-in-law, who's a Wayu Musmach and teaches at one of the yeshivas, he came on Shabbos and he disagreed. He thought that meeting every other week, that's not an occasional minion. That's, you know, an occasional minion is like a shiva, or if we decide just to grab a group together. he asked a Rav David Cohen, the postsake in Flatbush, and Rav David Cohen actually said that it is not an occasional minyan because we intend to have a minyan pretty much every week. So starting about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we began saying it. His psakim had enormous influence. In the Iraqi world, the Ben Ish Chai becomes the final authority, the universal authority in the Iraqi world. So much so that it was considered an outrage when Rav Avadya Yosef in the 1950s begins arguing intensively against the Ben Ish Chai and stating that now that we're in the land of Israel, we have to follow the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch, because the Ben Ish Chai had a number of rulings that diverged from the Shulchan Aruch for all sorts of reasons. And when Rav Avadya started affirming the supremacy of the Rav Yosef Karo, it created a huge controversy, and one of Rav Avadya's books was even burnt over this. I'm not going to speak about this now, although it is of interest to the Ben Ish Chai, only because a few of you asked me if I could continue with my series on Rav Avadya. We did the early years, up until he returns to Eretz Yisrael in the 1948 war. So when I finish with Rav Chanan Wasserman, and believe me, that's going to take me a long time with Rav Chanan Wasserman. I'm preparing it right now. There is so much to do with Rav Chanan. I'm looking at like 6-7 classes, I'm thinking. But once we finish with Rav Chanan, I'm going to go back to Rav Avadya and do the middle years. So then I'll discuss the whole the controversy, which, by the way, remained until the end of Rav Avadya's life. The split between him and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was attributed to this. The split between him and figures like Rav Yaakov Chaim Sofer and others, Rav Yaakov Moshe Hillel, this remained until the end of Rav Avadya's life, and they could never accept Rav Avadya as the Posek Acharon. So much so that people like Rav Yaakov Moshe Hillel, who are Iraqi and are really pretty much connected to the Eda Haredit, anti-Zionist, nevertheless, they had more allegiance and more connection to Rav Nissim or Mordechai Eliyahu, who were not just Zionists, in the case of Mordechai Eliyahu, super Zionist, than to Rav Avadya, because they saw Rav Avadya as a turncoat and that he abandoned the Iraqi tradition. Although the Ben Ish Chai was premier in Iraq, all was not smooth sailing. Is anything ever smooth sailing? But usually when I say all is not smooth sailing, it usually means there's other rabbis out to get you carp and create problems, just like I spoke about last class, Shemaria Menashe Adler going after Diane Hillman and Diane Abramsky. But that wasn't the case in Iraq. You didn't have another rabbi going after him. Instead, you had a man named Jacob Obermeyer. Who was Jacob Obermeyer? Well, he was a maskil. You can use that term. Really, the term is not used in the end of the 19th century, but he's an enlightened Jew, let's put it that way. Also a scholar, a real scholar. He comes to Baghdad to teach French at the Alliance School. The French opened up these schools to try to bring some secular education and modernize the situation of Jews in these Arab countries. They opened one in Baghdad. After a few years, Obermeyer starts teaching in Baghdad at the house of the exiled Persian prince. There's one of the Persian princes who wanted to be king made his way to Baghdad, and he becomes the house tutor. Obermeyer becomes the house tutor. And to plug it once again, there is an article, a very nice article, on Jacob Obermeyer. I'm looking at it right now in Wikipedia. I have no idea who wrote this article. Because the material in here does not come from the Jewish Encyclopedia or the Encyclopedia Judaica, neither of which have an entry on Jacob Obermeyer, and yet someone wrote a very, very nice article in Wikipedia about this person. There is even I don't know if it's Arabic or Persian, because I don't read it. It's probably Persian, Wikipedia article on Obermeyer as well. Let me just read you 2 seconds from it. He's a Bavarian Jewish Oriental researcher, grandfather of Israeli agent Mayor Max Binneth, who I don't know who that is. He's born in 1845. He studied under Chacham Bernays, Hirsch's teacher, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, and Rav Zeldman Bamberger. And then it describes how he traveled throughout North Africa, across the whole of the land of Israel and Syria and Damascus. It talks about him going to Baghdad. It won't. All it says is, while in Baghdad, Obermeyer clashed with the young Kabbalist Yosef Chaim and was excommunicated, his cherem being read in all the synagogues in Baghdad. So I'm going to tell you now what happened and why he was excommunicated. It talks about him being a teacher of a Persian royalty, then later he returned to Vienna. But in 1929, at the age of 84, his life work, The Landscape in the Era of the Babylonian Talmud and Gaonet, was published. This is an indispensable reference work on the geography from the Babylonian Talmud. It differs from the works of its predecessors in that, apart from the use and support of previous writers of antiquity, it rests on his personal experience. He traveled all over Babylonia, and he used this in order to write a book of geography of Talmudic and Gaonic Babylonia. I do not believe it's ever appeared in English, but I can't be sure. I forgot to check. Okay, so what's going on here? How does this guy who comes, Obermeyer, how does he end up being put in Cherem? Well, to know the answer to this, you have to look at an old newspaper called Hamagid. For years, I was always interested in this story because I saw references to it in Hamagid, but I can never access Hamagid. Harvard actually has the bound copies of all the issues. Hamagid was a Haskalah newspaper. So I can call Obermeyer Haskalah, a Maskil, definitely, because he's in... It's the 1870s. I still can use the term Maskil then. Once you get to later on, they don't like using the term Maskil. You know, when people are Zionists, you don't call them Maskilim. But I'm going to use the term anyway, Maskil. Anyone who really wants a more enlightened outlook, without getting involved in Zionism or nationalism or anything like that. But so I haven't been back in Cambridge in years. However, a few years ago, this website opened up called Jewish Hebrew Newspapers or something like that by the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the Jewish National University Library, and they have loads of old Hebrew newspapers, complete runs, like Halev HaNon, Chavat Zelot, and one of them they have is Hamagid. And with the click of a mouse, you can pull up the series. It's a whole series of Obermeyer's reports from Baghdad to back to Europe, where Hamagid was published, reporting on what he saw. Unfortunately for Obermeyer, there were people in Baghdad. I was looking through the newspaper. You have letters coming in from rabbis in Baghdad. So the newspaper was being sent to Baghdad. So if he thought that people in Baghdad wouldn't know what he said, he was sadly mistaken. Yechezkel says that today they say Hamelitz and Hamagid are Haredi papers. I don't know why they have their own newspapers called Hamelitz and Hamagid. No one's saying that the old Hamelitz and Hamagid. By the way, Hamagid was not a... It was a Haskalah paper, but it was a firm paper. It was an Orthodox paper. I started going through it. It's late at night and I'm tired, I try to read a few issues. You have letters there from Ratzvi Hirsch Kaplischer. You have letters from the Netziv. You have all sorts of rabbis writing for it. On the other hand, you have Yaakov Reifman. You have articles that refer to Geiger positively. It's from Haskalah. That's exactly what it is. From Haskalah, today we could say modern Orthodoxy. That's what from Haskalah is. But it's far removed from Haredi. And yes, it was part of the Musar dispute because they reported on all the Musar disputes and they took sides, etc. All these people were Shomer Shabbos, but they were definitely Maskilim. So let me tell you a little bit about what Yaakov Obermeyer says. And his first report is February 16th, 1876. It's not his first report. It's his first report dealing with the Ben Yishai. He had a number of prior articles, or at least two, I believe, if I recall correctly, discussing Baghdad. People were interested. You know, that was the Orient. That was, it was so far away, unimaginable. People were interested in knowing, you know, how Jews are living in these parts of the world. So these travel logs, like I just showed you, of Israel Joseph Benjamin, people found that fascinating to read about life in this faraway place. So in this issue, he gets to, he starts speaking about Yosef Chaim. He says, let me just paraphrase for you, I'm looking at it right now. There is a person among the sages here, his name is Yosef Chaim, and let me tell you, readers of Hamagid, about him. Because this guy lords over the simple people, and he's created a new path, which is different than had ever existed in Baghdad before him. And he goes on to say that this Yosef Chaim, he grabs on both extremes. What do I mean by that? In one way, he acts, and his attitude is just like Echad HaRebiyim, not Rabbanim. Resh Bet Yud Yud Mem. That's Rebbe's, Hasidic Rebbe. So on one hand, HaPolanim. So on one hand, he's like a Polish Hasidic Rebbe. And he's referring to his attachment to Kabbalah, superstition, all these things that Obermeyer doesn't like. And then he says, on the other hand, Gam Midat Geiger, Nishkabo. On the other hand, he's like Abraham Geiger. That's a weird combination. On the one hand, he's like a Hasidic Rebbe. And on the other hand, he's like Geiger. Well, he's going to explain. He says, at some time, Palm Yitzaveh, one time, he'll tell everyone around him to do everything like the Mekubalim. Just like the Chavein B'Tfilatam Kari HaKadosh, to do all the Kavanot of Rav Isaac Luria, and to do dancing, he says, make all their days Chagim, B'Mishta, or Akida, or then change it and do everyone, you should do fast days for days and days. So in that sense, he's like a Abraham Geiger. Like the Hasidic Rebbe. On the other hand, what does he say? In his books, you find he criticizes Gedolei Yisroel Ukdoshav. Obermeyer says that he's just like a Reform rabbi, this Yosef Chaim. He's like Geiger, because you open up his Sfarim, and he's criticizing Gedolei Yisroel and their practices. Mishana Tfilotenu. Hasadurat Olamim Mekedem. He's changing our tefillot, which is true. The Ben Ishchai was correcting tefillot, saying, you did it up to now this way, it's a mistake, change it. So he's like Geiger. He's telling the Jews of Baghdad that he told them already that their tefillin were no good. He's telling them that their tefillas are no good. Mishana Tfilotenu Hasadurat Olamim Mekedem. He's changing our tefillot that we've had from days of old. That's a play on words here. He's creating new things, and he's making battles to change Minhag Yisrael. Then he says, the reason why he's also trouble is because he's rich. He has all this money, and the money he has is what's... because he doesn't have to depend on anyone, he has all his own money, that's what this author thinks is encouraging him to do all sorts of strange things. And to lord over and to be, much greater and be a big shot around all the other rabbis who are poor. And so we see already, and we're just getting started, we see already that Obermeyer doesn't like him. And I'm going to continue with this next class, but now I want to continue with his attack and what it led to, but now I want to speak about what I mentioned to you, because I promised a couple people already. So let me end with the Ben Ishchai now. Let me tell you about what I promised. For those who are here, we lost one or two people. And then I'll take questions on the Ben Ishchai or what I'm going to tell you right now. In the past, we've mentioned, let me get my paper here. In the past, we've mentioned Rav Huttner, the great Rav Yitzhak Huttner, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. In my new book, Changing the Immutable, I deal with him and his relationship to Rav Kook. So that'll be of interest. But now I want to speak about a different matter, which I mentioned in the past, and lots of people have asked me, and that's the hijacking that took place in the 1970s, about which there's an entire book by a man named David Rabb, who was on the plane, and he lives half a year in Teaneck. or he lives both Teaneck and Renana. At least that's what it says on the book. I don't know. Maybe he lives in Renana and comes back for work. I don't know him, but some you and Teaneck, you probably know him. There, Rasputner has got a lot of bad publicity over this. And all sorts of bad things are said about him, what he did do, didn't do, and people have said that's the reason there's no article biography of him, because they couldn't write about this episode. That's nonsense. First of all, if article wanted to write a biography, either they could just not really speak about the episode, just gloss over it, or they could make things up, like article often does. They could say that on the plane, he was the comfort for all the passengers, etc. That's not the reason why article didn't do the biography. But, as I said, Rasputner has been harshly criticized, and I don't think that's fair, but when I tell you what really happened, I actually think it helps his reputation, in a way, because I don't think you can look down on what happened. He's a person, just like everyone else. True, he didn't measure up to what we would hope that our Gadolin do, but it's not like he did anything bad, and it's not like he should be subject to any sort of abuse, as people have over the years. And the facts haven't always been okay. I've seen references that described, and I mentioned this in this class, which is why I want to correct it for the record, that he asked for himself special treatment, and they brought him. He was removed from all the other hijack passengers with his son-in-law and daughter, and they were kept away from everyone else. And that's been written, and I reported it as well here. It's not true. I'm going to tell you the truth right now, and where do I get it from? I was fortunate to go to Buffalo a few months ago for a scholar in residence. And living in Buffalo is a woman named Rivka Klein Berkovitz. She is the daughter of Rabbi Isaac Klein from Buffalo. Isaac Klein of Buffalo is also a name you should all know, because he is someone who begins at Yeshiva College, Reitz. He mentions in one of his books, even his Code of Jewish Law, the Mechater, who was his teacher. Then before getting smicha, he leaves. He goes to the seminary. He's one of only three people to get smicha, personal smicha, from Louis Ginsberg. The other two being Louis Finkelstein, and Boaz Cohen. He then becomes, he's from Hungary. He then becomes a rabbi. He's actually an Orthodox, serves as rabbi of an Orthodox shul. Probably wondering, how is it that a graduate of the seminary is a rabbi of an Orthodox shul? Louis Finkelstein was also a graduate of an Orthodox shul. If YCT is ever totally moved out and turned into the non-Orthodox column, people will look back and say all these Orthodox shuls had YCT graduates. Well, but the seminary was very different then. He becomes a rabbi in Springfield, Massachusetts, 1948 to 1953. I think those are the years. Which, by the way, is post-World War II, so it's one thing when Louis Finkelstein was a rabbi of an Orthodox shul in the 30s, you shouldn't be having Orthodox rabbis, you shouldn't be having rabbis of Orthodox shuls in the late 1940s, early 1950s from the seminary, even if they're a complete bucky and Shas and Poskim like Isaac Klein, because the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement were really separated enough by then, there was no longer any distinction, no longer any question that there was a distinction, unlike in earlier years. This synagogue, Congregation Kadima in Springfield, is later taken over, not many years after he leaves. He might even be the successor, I think, though there was one rabbi that went between them, by none other than Norman Lamb. Norman Lamb was also rabbi of that synagogue. And he wrote many works. He wrote Response on Halachic Studies, the volume. He wrote that Code of Jewish Law, which is used by the conservative movement, which if you just take out, it's about 500 pages. If you just take out the stuff in there about cheese and wine, it could be used in any Orthodox school as a very nice Kitzur Shulchan Aruch in English. It's an excellent book. It's completely halachic. He wasn't completely halachic as an individual in that he did give the permission for the seminary to allow converts to marry a kohen. He wrote a tshuva on that. So he does diverge a bit, but he's a completely Shomer Shabbos. And his children, as far as I know, all were really in the Orthodox world, or grandchildren. Someone told me that one of his grandchildren drinks non-kosher wine because although he's Orthodox, he holds of his grandfather. So he has a daughter named Rivka Klein Berkovitz, who lives in Buffalo and goes to the Orthodox Shul. And when I was there, I was fortunate I had the opportunity to speak to her and interview her. She was on that plane with her husband, and that was hijacked. And not only was she on the plane, she was sitting right next to Rav Huttner. I don't know if it's literally the seat next to her, but the seat a little bit over. And the way she described it to me, first of all, she said it's absolutely not true that Rav Huttner was taken to a different area. He was with them the entire time. The problem was that, you know, we have this idea of Gedol Yisroel. In fact, she told me that her father, when her father heard that Rav Huttner was on the plane with her, he felt a great sigh of relief, because then he knew that she'd be, that all the passengers on the plane, they had Rav Huttner on the plane, that he would be their leader, and it gave her father a lot of comfort. And he was sort of shocked, she said, not sort of, he was shocked when she described afterwards what happened, when she came out and told him. Rav Huttner wanted nothing to do with the other passengers. He refused to be a leader. People were coming over to him, they had nothing to eat. And they were given food by the terrorists, and people were coming over to Rav Huttner and asking him, can they eat this, can they eat that? And he refused to answer. He says, I don't want to get involved. And Mrs. Berkovitz said to him, how could you not, and she was a young mother, she said to him, how could you not answer this? These people need to know what the halacha is. They need to know, you know, what they can eat, what they can't eat. And he said that, don't ask me questions and tell them not to ask me any questions, because if you do, then the terrorists, this is Black September, will realize I'm someone important. I don't look down on Rav Huttner because of this. I mean, no one knows how we're going to act if we're put in a situation like this, where Rav Huttner said that a message was sent from the terrorists to the outside, from Rav Huttner, stating that blood will be spilled if they don't settle this. No one knows how they're going to react. Sometimes people who we expect to be the leaders end up not wanting that role. And that's they're entitled to that. And none of us know how we're going to act. And some people who you never would expect rise to the fore. And I don't think it's fair, therefore, to criticize Rav Huttner. He was not a leader on the plane. He disappointed everyone on the plane. He decided to be for himself, like everyone has the right to be. But he didn't do anything bad in that sense. He simply showed that he didn't measure up. He could be a great gadol and a great Torah scholar normally, but when, you know, guys were holding guns in front of you and things like that, he didn't have it. And I don't see that as a flaw that people need to look down upon. You know, maybe we'd want better, but that's, you know, you can't blame someone for that. One other thing she told me, which she heard him say personally, is that he told the hijackers that if they release him, he will make sure they get a lot of money. That's a bit problematic, perhaps, as well. Although, if anyone else would do that, I don't think anyone could criticize them. If you have money and you can get out, you don't need to stay there for everyone else. You're not the captain that you have to go down with the ship or anything like that. Like with Entebbe, when the crew of the Air France jet chose to remain with the Jewish passengers. Remember, it wasn't Israelis. It was Jews. They separated all the Jews. It wasn't just Rav Huttner, though. He didn't know this, but his students in America were doing the same thing. They had made contact with certain people who they thought could get him in touch with the terrorists, and they were willing to pay millions of dollars to get Rav Huttner out. This went to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Rav Moshe Feinstein said, no, it's forbidden to ransom him. I'm not sure halachically why it's forbidden, because unless the argument is that the money is too much, and it's above what he's worth. Even like Mayor of Rothenburg refused to allow himself to be ransomed. But if you can get someone out, oh, and the reason given by Ramosha is that we don't, at least this is the way it's written. He said that we're not going to favor a Rosh Hashiva. I think you do favor. If you can only save one person, that is who you would. I think the real reason is that Ramosha realized that if something, can you imagine the Chil Hashem? The Chil HaTorah, if you would take out, instead of the Rosh Yeshiva remaining with the passengers, the Rosh Yeshiva is the one taken out. People would say, Zo Torah, this is Torah, that the great rabbi doesn't remain with everyone else and saves his own skin. So it really was a bracha. And by the way, had Rav Huttner had this scheme, which never could have gotten off the ground, but had this scheme ever gotten off the ground, and Rav Huttner was released because they were paid off, that would have been the end of Rafuto's reputation, and we would not be considering him a Gadol Yisrael now. He would be cursed by the Jewish people for doing such a thing. So it really is good for his own reputation that such a thing never happened. That's the story. It's never been written up. You've heard all sorts of things that he kept himself aloof, which he did, but he separated himself. He didn't separate himself. He sat there with them. I don't think it's fair, now that I've given you the whole story, to judge him negatively. He didn't, as I say, measure up to what we would hope a leader would, but no one knows who's going to be a leader in those circumstances. None of us, I don't think, listening right now, know how we'd react. David Rabb was interviewed, and he said, where some of the passengers on the plane came out with very negative feelings towards Rafuttner, David Rabb said he didn't come out with negative feelings. He quotes in the book one crazy thing. The passengers were giving out sodas, and Rafuttner says, well, can I have a cold one? And people were, and by the way, Berkovitz mentioned this also. They were all flabbergasted. At this moment in time, you're asking for a cold soda? So that's the story. It's important, I think, to get the historical record out, if only because so much untruth has been said, and it gives us an insight into the man, and I think it also shows us that you can be a Gadol Yisrael and not always be super brave. Rabbi Soloveitchik was not always super brave in certain halachic matters. At least people in the know say that he was afraid of being at... Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg was definitely afraid of stating his opinion because of the response. So we have Gadolim who are afraid. Rafuttner here. That's all I want to say about it. It doesn't affect my view of him as a great Torah sage, because I recognize that different Torah sages will respond differently under different circumstances, and we look towards him to be a great Torah scholar. That doesn't necessarily mean when the chips are down, he's going to be like the people who started the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt. Not everyone's made like that, and I don't think it takes away from who he was. Yes, the other daughter, Ira, mentions she passed away, I think it was in 2005. And he wasn't a posek, no, but the posek has nothing to do with it. He was a Rosh Yeshiva. We had the situation of Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum during the war, but not so much Rabbi Yoel as much as the Belzer Rebbe. The Belzer Rebbe left. Does the Belzer Rebbe need to stay and die with everyone? Some rabbis thought that they should stay. Others thought no. And by the way, the Hasidim always thought that the Rebbe should leave. They even made substitutions for like the Belzer and the Gerer, so the Nazis went no. All I'm saying is that Rafuttner didn't act like a leader, but who says he needs to act like a leader? We'd like him to, and it would be great if he did, and the people were disappointed, but if he didn't, I don't think that takes away from who he is. We never hired him to be a leader under fire. He was hired to teach Torah and to guide, and that's what I'm saying. You can disagree. Yecheskel, you say that it's going to be on Failed Messiah. Let it be on Failed Messiah. I hope he puts it on. He doesn't listen. He listened to that one class because someone alerted him to it. Let him put it on. The things that have been said about Rafuttner have been bad things. I don't think this is bad. If people see this, they'll see that he's a person, and there's nothing, if you know what, people already assume a lot worse. And after he passed away, people said things, so this should get the record out what happened. Lyra says Rafuttner never recovered psychologically and was somewhat isolated from the Bachrim in the Beis Medrash. She remembers. I didn't realize that you were at Chaim Berlin there. It was a horrible, horrible experience. If you read Ira Rabb's book, it was a horrible experience. From my perspective, we don't require our Gedolim to be put in those circumstances. If it was a Rav Gorin, who was a soldier and a fighter and had been under fire, that would be something else. Rafuttner never had any experience with this sort of thing. Why should we expect Rafuttner to be stand up and be a leader and rally everyone around him any more than we should expect any other individual, any professor, any business leader? That's not how people react. No one knows. You were saying, referring to answer about the non-kosher food, Yossi. No, that's, come on. Rafuttner's not a posek, but if the people, the balabatim, the masses are coming up to him and saying, can they eat the food, he has to answer that. He's the only rabbi there. But he didn't. He was afraid. He was afraid that they'd see he's someone important, and then they would use him, which they probably would have, had they known that he was. As Mrs. Berkowitz pointed out to me, though, that seemed to be contradicted. On the one hand, he doesn't want to be important. On the other hand, he says that he can get a lot of money. Okay, you could say he's rich, maybe, but he's not important. I understand exactly why he didn't want them asking him questions. Okay, Ira says that Rafutner was disappointed in himself. I'm sure he was. When you look back, when everything turns out okay, you're going to ask yourself, could I have done more? Was I the leader? So that's the situation. And the Rav Moshe point of not agreeing to ransom him is, I think, really interesting because why did they feel they needed to go to Rav Moshe? But that's how it's told. The other sources state that it wasn't just Rav Moshe, it was also Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, which makes sense to me. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky also was involved and said that we cannot get involved with ransoming everyone. It's pretty obvious that it would have been a terrible Chilul Hashem if that could have happened. It wasn't. Okay, I'll stay on for more than a couple minutes. If anyone wants to ask questions on this, and or questions on the Ben Ishchai, I'll take it. I really don't think that what I said now is negative to Rafutner's reputation. I actually think it's positive in this sense. Not that that's why I'm doing it. I'm trying to give you the historical facts because there have been so many negative things said about the experience and how he purposely got himself placed away from everyone else, etc. I think this is telling you it helps the reputation a bit and shows us the reality. Shlomo says, it isn't a lack of bravery or leadership, it's not wanting to endanger himself. That's correct. He didn't want to endanger himself. You could say, though, that it's a lack of bravery, people need you. The people, Mrs. Berkowitz and others, thought that it was a lack of bravery, that they were looking for a leader, and here is the great Rosh Yeshiva. But from Rav Huttner's perspective, he has to... I don't judge him negatively for this. In retrospect, I wish he could have answered some questions because I know that in the end, he wouldn't have been killed. And in the end, he would have been freed and all would have been. But at the time, who knew that? So we can understand Rafutner's approach, especially he has his daughter there and his son-in-law. And we can also understand the other people's approach. Who were they supposed to look to? They're looking to the Rosh Yeshiva. These are simple Jews. I'm not talking about the non-religious Jews. What do the non-religious Jews know who he is? They don't know. They don't care. But we're dealing with people like Mrs. Berkowitz, religious Jews, who, and that's why she told me that her father was so disappointed when he had such comfort knowing that Rav Huttner was there. And afterwards, when she told him that Rav Huttner didn't step up to be a leader, he was very disappointed. So, but as Shlomo said, this might have been the correct halachic decision. If the terrorists would have seen one individual who everyone's coming to ask questions to, all of a sudden they have a new hostage, not just a typical Jewish hostage. They have a special hostage. Can you imagine if they announced to the world that we have one of the great rabbis? The State Department knew about this. If you read Rab's book, the State Department was informed that there's a great rabbi on the plane. But if the terrorists knew that they had a great rabbi, for them that's hostage number one. Think of what they could all of a sudden raise their demands now. Hundredfold. It's like all of a sudden you capture a senator. If you hijack an airplane and you have a senator or something like that on the plane, I understand Rav Huttner, and I'll just say it again. I'm not criticizing him. I don't think he deserves to be criticized. Even in retrospect, maybe what he did was correct. But I just want to let you know the facts by an eyewitness, the one who was sitting right next to him, and there are other eyewitnesses as well. Ellie says, to what extent did the Ben Ishchai view an occupation as necessary in the life of a Torah scholar? Next class, we'll speak about the Ben Ishchai's view of Torahim Derech Eretz. Not only was he not one of these religious fanatics, he was far from it. He believed in working and all these things, but that'll be next class. Yossi says, there was a suggestion to offer a huge sum to ransom Rav Huttner, and since Tosfot permits paying exorbitant sum to save a great Rav, Yaakov ruled that this only applies during peacetime, but it doesn't apply during war. I think it's the new volume that came out, that big thick volume of came out last year of Rav Moshe's material. It talks In fact, I know it's in there. They ask him about the Rafutner case. I think I have it right here. I'll give it to you, those who want to check it. It's in Rav Felder, Aaron Felder's book. Rishumei Aharon, Volume 2, Page 8. That it's Rav Moshe rejected attempts to rescue Rav Huttner when he was on the plane. So it's both of them. Who knows? Maybe they did have a connection. Thank you, Yossi, for that. Yecheskel asks, do I think the people at Hamelitz were the clowns, Dove Katz, Payne sent to be, or something in the middle? Dove Katz is a partisan of the Musar movement. Hamelitz didn't like the Musar movement. The Hamelitz crowd, they liked Rabbi Shaul Salanter, but they thought that what it became was a bunch of also crazy people, religious fanatical types. He's going to be opposed to them. If you look, though, at the people who were writing in Hamelitz, these were enlightened traditional Jews, including great rabbis. You had great rabbis writing for it as well. Yeshua Kohen Gadol was in the time of Zechariah, when he just returned from the second base of Midrash. I'll stay on for a couple more minutes if anyone has questions. Yossi, getting back to your point, we spoke in the past about this idea of ransom, and that we don't pay ransom. However, there are people who say that for family, you can pay any ransom you want. For example, if my son is kidnapped, the community is not supposed to pay an exorbitant ransom. However, an individual, a parent, that is not an individual, a parent, can't be told how much to pay. You could make a case, I think, that a Rebbe is like a father figure. And therefore, according to this view, that family members can pay as much as they want to rescue a Rebbe, who we know your father brings you into this world, the Rebbe brings you into the next world, you could make a case that even exorbitant fees could be paid to rescue a Rebbe if someone wanted to make that case. It says multiple attendees are typing, but nothing is popping up. Let me take these last couple things here. Shlomo says he has a memory of asking his grandfather, whose grandfather is a great Talmud Chacham and well-known Rav, Gadol B'Yisrael, why Yeshua Kohen Gadol was not mentioned in the battle against non-Jewish wives, and him telling me it must be like the Gemara says the Yomi elsewhere, that he went back to Bavel. Did your grandfather know that the Kever is in Bavel? If your grandfather knew the Kever was in Bavel, then I'm not as impressed. But if he says that not knowing the Kever is in Bavel, that's really something interesting. But it's an excellent question you have, Shlomo. Why Yeshua and Kod is not mentioned, and maybe they go back to Bavel, but why would the Kohen Gadol go back to Bavel? Okay. Thank you all. It's a good point. I teach that passage in Ezra, the book of Ezra, about to my classes about getting rid of the foreign wives, and you don't have the religious leader there. You have the political leader there, Ezra, but you don't have the religious leader, the Kohen Gadol. And so tell your grandfather, I give him a very, not that he needs it from me, but a very big Yasha Koach. So good night, everyone. Look forward to seeing you all next week.